This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you again by the Friends of the Magic Word. We want to thank all of those patrons who have donated or pledged their monthly support to the Magic Word, and it's because of friends like you that we are able to keep this podcast going and to pay for our production costs and keep it going, as I said, every week. We've been doing this now for well over 560 episodes, golly, and almost 10 years coming up here soon. And this week, we want to welcome two new people. That's Richard J. Tracy and also Daniel Norrett. Thank you very much, Dan and Richard. Appreciate you guys pledging to the Magic Word and becoming the newest Friends of the Magic Word. If you're interested in learning more about how that you can help participate and keep this going, then just go to themagicwordpodcast.com. There you can click on a tab that says Become a Friend, and you could watch a video, you could read some information, find out why that your support is sorely needed, particularly right now when a lot of things are happening such that we have lost some supporters and there have been some decreases in some donations and pledges for obvious reasons right now. So anything that you can do to assist would be greatly appreciated then as well. Well, we are also then into our eighth week of the Magician's Relief Project, and that's been going very well, and we still have a couple more weeks to go left on that. And so I want to thank those who have participated with their financial aid to give towards magicians who could use this relief. Also, a couple of weeks ago, we talked with Mark D'Souza, and he had offered a couple of prizes, and we have selected the names, and I will tell you who those two winners are on the backside of this podcast with our guest this week. And I'm excited to announce who we have here with us this week, and that is Michael Close. Mike has been a longtime friend of mine, and I always enjoy spending time with him. He is very clever, and not just because he's funny, but his ideas and everything. The Worker series he had was instrumental in really helping with my repertoire when I'm working at restaurants. Still some things from those books that are in my regular act all the time. Just some marvelous, marvelous ideas. Very creative thinker. He also then was the trick editor for Magic Magazine for a number of years, and of course the editor for MUM, for the Society of American Magicians, for a long time. And most recently has been the magic consultant for Penn & Teller Foolish Television Show. And with Johnny Thompson's passing, that just leaves him as being the sole magic consultant in working with that. Well, during this podcast, just to give you a quick overview, he talks about all these things and goes into a lot more detail. You know, of times that, well, I'm not going to spoiling the stories. A lot of really good stuff. And this is a rather long podcast, so I don't want to delay any longer. So please welcome my friend here this week, Mr. Michael Close, here on The Magic Word. Well, today has been a long time coming of someone that I've been wanting to talk with for quite some time, and we run into each other from time to time in different places, whether they're conventions or lectures. I remember many years ago, I had this gentleman come through for a lecture through Houston, and we have broken bread together, been around for a while, and this is a guy that I know is very well known to you. You probably have at least one or more of his books in your library, perhaps DVDs and everything then as well, perhaps most notably and recently being associated with Penn & Teller Foolish, and had worked with Johnny Thompson and all the other guys behind the scenes and making this thing work. And also, not only a master magician, but a master musician, which I highly recommend if you get a chance then to get a copy of his CD. It is really pretty cool, and I listen to it still from time to time. So please welcome my friend Michael Close. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Scott. Thank you for spending some time with me. I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you very much for being available. Because I said, whenever that I know we're like at a convention that you are behind the scenes working with something or getting ready for a lecture, or you're going to be the MC for the evening show or something. And so it's kind of hard to pull you aside for an hour actually to sit down to do something. And you're probably going to less and less conventions nowadays, I guess. Is that right? I haven't seen you really at a convention for a while.
I think the last time you and I saw each other was at the IBM convention in San Diego. Was it? I think it was San Diego. And I think I recall that we were outdoors having a chat or something like that.
Yeah, we were walking actually between the hotel and the afternoon session. I think that you were going to be hosting or something. Or was that the IBM SAM combined convention, perhaps?
Oh, yes. We saw each other there. I don't know if we recorded anything there. Yeah, you and I were walking. I was going to host the formal close-up presentation with Jay Sankey. And,
in fact, Jay was kind of walking quickly by us, and we said hello as he kind of was passing by as we chatted.
Well, Jay Sankey has the record, I think, for the fastest sprint off a stage after the cast came out for their final curtain call. It was, good night, everyone. And there was just, it was a cloud of dust like in a Roadrunner cartoon. And Sankey was gone. So he's over the years, he's managed to hone that skill to near perfection.
Well, he has always something to go to. I mean, he's got to get ready to put out tomorrow's email, you know.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
No, he keeps busy, you know, with that. And speaking of which, I know that you have Michael Close's newsletter, which if people don't subscribe to, they should, since that you many years ago then were the editor-in-chief then for the MUM magazine or journal for the SAM. And you're just an excellent writer. Prior to that, you worked for Magic Magazine, I know, in trick reviews and everything, but then turned it over to Joshua J. And so.
Yeah. That I started writing reviews for Magic Magazine in 1995, and at the time I still lived in Indiana. And Mac was, I don't even know if Mac King was in Vegas at that point in 1995. He might still have been in Los Angeles. And we tried to do it long distance. The goal was, and this could end up being a long story, so at any time blow the buzzer and say, we've heard just enough, or start the playoff music or something.
This isn't AGT, you know.
Yeah, very good. I'm all for it then. The idea was that we would do like a Siskel and Ebert situation. So we'd both get copies of whatever product was going to be reviewed, and then we'd sort of have one or the other of us would write an introductory kind of an overview type of review of the thing, and then he and I would discuss back and forth and talk about good points and low points. The problem was in 1995, the technology did not exist to do that in any way that was at all comfortable. Mm-hmm. We ended up doing it by text through something. I don't know what the hookup was, but we were sort of typing back and forth with each other. And it really was clunky and didn't work so well. Eventually, Mac stopped after 1 year of doing it because he didn't like the aspect of it that it costs friendship sometimes to be a product reviewer. For us, the big crunch was that the first book we had to review in the very first column we wrote was the last book that Carol Fox put out, and it simply was not a very good book. As I've told people, it's not a book of creation, it's a book of recollection. And if you're going to do a book of recollection, then you should really also recollect whose trick it is that you're putting in your book. And he didn't do that. And I'll mention something that I haven't really told to the general public, but this really cost my friendship with Carol Fox. He sent me quite an angry letter and wanted to know, well, exactly what in the book wasn't his. And I had to send him back this long list of things that he included, not saying that it was his, but not saying that it wasn't his, which I believe is a responsibility when you put out a book.
Sure.
One of the things in there was, I just got done on my live Facebook video talking for very briefly about Out of This World. And one of the ideas in Carol's book was that you pencil dot the Joker in whatever deck you're using, and it can be anywhere it is, just wherever it falls randomly in the deck.
Sure.
And as the spectator deals, you can see when he gets to the pencil dotted card, and you stop the spectator. And you say, hang on a minute, I'm getting a weird vibe from that card, put it aside. And then they continue, and then at the end, after everything's been shown separated, you turn over that card, and it turns out to be the Joker. This, of course, is a very clever, nice little bit on the Out of This World thing. It also is included in the original instructions that Paul Curry put out. So this is the kind of things we pointed out. And because of it, my relationship with Carol was fractured, and I really was sad about that, but we couldn't do anything else.
you know,
we had, go ahead.
That's a very good point. And I think not only with that, that people who are reviewers, people who are reading reviews or watching them online or whatever, you have to trust that person. You have to have some sort of relationship, I guess, with the reader or the viewer that they trust you. Because if you like everything, then it's like, you know, it's lukewarm. You know, you need to actually have an opinion one way. Like Jamie Ian Swiss. Now, there's a guy, you know, who would, you know, tells it like it is. And he's always made a point of that if I really don't like it, I'm going to go into even more detail why I don't, rather than just dropping this bomb, which I really respect, you know, then as well.
Well, I was going to say that's unfortunately one of the problems with having to write a negative review. Because if I love something, I just love everything about it, I don't have to say very much about it. I can just say, I love everything about this. But if there's things I don't like, then I have to back up that, and it's very important that everybody keeps this in mind, I have to back up that opinion with the facts that I think are relevant to my making that decision. And before I jump back to you, I just want to make one more comment about reviewing. You are absolutely right that, and this is why, even though it was an enormous amount of work for me doing it as one person, which I did after the first year, so Mac started in 95 and left when the year 1996 started. And so I did it all by myself for 9 years. That was way more work than a single person should be involved in, because we were just getting to the point where the marketplace was getting overwhelmed with product. But the good thing about a single person writing a review is, as a reader, you begin to understand that person's taste and viewpoint. In the same way that you might have a friend, and I have a friend, and his opinion of movies is diametrically opposite to mine. To the point that if he recommends a film, I know I'm going to hate it.
Siskel and Ebert kind of a thing.
And the other way around. So anyway, yeah, it's a very difficult job. And it's also real important that people understand that it's not truth. It is opinion. But it's opinion that, especially in a negative case, it has to be backed up with whatever supporting evidence you have for that opinion.
Well, and a lot of that, of course, has to do with your perspective and your base of comparison and your history and what you have seen and done in order to feel that you are the expert that can deliver that kind of opinion. But I understand where you're coming from, is that you do risk that possibility of losing some good friends because of your honesty.
Absolutely. During the period that I was doing it, and even after the fact, I've said to people, it's important to remember, I'm not reviewing you as a person. I'm reviewing this product. I'm not saying you're a bad person. I'm saying I don't think this product is worth the money.
Right.
And most of the time, the things that I judge something on are sort of the 3 points that Darwin Ortiz mentioned about before you publish a trick, you have to ask the question, have I improved this effect in either the presentation of it, the method of it, or the actual effect itself. I mean, have I made some improvement in one of those three areas? If all you've really done is move the trick sideways, many times I'm not so certain that qualifies as a justification for publishing anything, because certainly at a certain level of experience with any type of magic, you know enough stuff that you can look at a trick and go, oh, you know, I can't do that move particularly well, but I can do this other move, so I'll use this other move. Well, that's simply a personalization. That may or may not move the trick forward.
That's like painting a blue box red, basically.
Well, exactly. That's the whole joke. You know, the red deck, blue deck. I do it with a red deck, commentary on that kind of thing. So that was sort of my underlying thing. And the other thing was that I tried to just really sort of make some sense of a decision whether the product was worth the money. Whether if some kid, I mean, when I was growing up, and it was late in my life, I got Genie magazine, and I think I also got The Linking Ring, and I would read the reviews in those magazines because I wasn't around anybody. I had no magicians to bounce anything off of, and many times those reviews were the only way to guide me toward what I was thinking about buying, although I did have the opportunity because by then, Dick Stoner in Fort Wayne, we were friends, And I would write to him or call the shop and say, is this good? Would you ask Dick to come to the phone? I need to ask him about something. And he'd be able to tell me if he felt that something was worth the price. So that's sort of the kind of guidepost I wanted to be for magicians who had no other way to find anything out. Of course, this was very early on in the spread of the Internet, and now there's so many more ways that you can find out whether a product is worthwhile.
That's true. Well, you know, going back for just a minute then, Michael, about that you had mentioned crediting people, but like when Carol Fox and kind of losing your friendship there. There was a book, a mentalism book, that I believe was James Biss had put out some years ago.
Yes.
That were not his effects, and so they said, hey, you didn't credit so-and-so, and so they went back and said, okay, so we started in the second edition. He did credit it, but they still weren't his tricks, you know, kind of a thing. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Well, I don't specifically recall those books, but that sort of thing happened with Frank Garcia in his Million Dollar Card Secrets or Million Dollar Card Mysteries, and then the Green Book. I forget what the Green Book was called, but he put out two books. And in the first book, almost everything in that book is not Frank Garcia's. Mm-hmm. So when the second book, when the Green Book was published, in the back of it, you'll find the credits for the Red Book and the Blue Book, and you'll find out where all this stuff came from. But I think it's only fair. You're not diminishing yourself as a creator by acknowledging the work of the people who came before you.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is, you know, too often we look at, people look at a situation as, well, doesn't this diminish me? Well, no, it clearly doesn't, because you are enough of a scholar to realize that we all build, you know, by standing on the shoulders of giants, and all this stuff comes somewhere. Sometimes a credit is unavailable, and I just didn't know about it. I mean, I was very proud of a trick I published in Closely Guarded Secrets called The Cheating Lessons, because I thought, well, I came up with the idea, I mean, I didn't read it anywhere, of adding a four of a kind and using it as a double dupe, which means an extra strong hand that shows up with the Marlowe Gardner poker deal. And I was really felt pretty good about the fact that I'd figured this thing out. But then I found out from Tony Cabral that it was actually in Hugard's Magic Monthly, and now I won't be able to remember who it was that published it, but a clever guy, so I can't feel bad about it. Mm-hmm. A very clever guy beating me to the punch. But from now on, when I talk about that trick, I'm going to have to include that credit, because it does predate me. I mean, there's certainly nothing wrong with independent invention.
Right.
But when you find out that somebody put it in print, that has to be acknowledged to the first guy.
I agree. And my question, I guess, to you is, how far do we go with that and trying to credit back, in which that after a point, you know, some people are buying a book is like, okay, I appreciate that he's credited that, but I really want to get to the trick, and they really kind of skip over that, unfortunately, which is an important part. I guess what I'm getting to as well is that, are we one of the only arts, I guess, or not just that, I guess, but people who actually go to these links of trying to credit each other. I'm thinking, for an example, about doctors who are writing in not just manuals, but in medical journals, et cetera. You know, they might refer to the Jakowitz, heart transplant or whatever kind of a thing, you know, that they're referring to someone's name, but they're not saying this was something that was based on so-and-so and going back, you know, to however far. So, they don't necessarily give credit to whomever. I don't believe the same way that we do. And I'm just using that as an example.
I think I have to disagree with that. I'm not a scientist, and I don't really spend a lot of time reading scientific papers. But for an example, I do read music PhD theses, especially when they apply to jazz, and I find whatever I can. And if you write a doctoral dissertation, your dissertation damn well better be full of citations and where the things that you mentioned came from.
I see.
Or you're not going to get approved for that PhD. And here's the thing that magicians don't understand about crediting. Not only does the credit tell you what the inspiration for the idea was, but it gives you a source where you can go back and look at it yourself and perhaps take that idea in a different direction. Mm-hmm. So you could look at, when I, if I, it was Orville Meyer was the guy that I was trying to think of. So If I tell you you can find Orville Meyer's original routine in this issue of Hugard's Magic Monthly, and you go back there, you'll go, oh, wow, well, that's interesting. You know, I think I may want to do the trick this way because it's a much simpler trick than what Mike does. And you just have no idea where that's going to happen. Now, in the old days, and by the old days, I mean pre-robust internet days, that research would be really difficult. You'd go visit Jay Marshall and pour through his stacks of books or what have you. But now with sources, and I give a huge tip of my hat to Dennis Baer, who's not only a brilliant man, but certainly as hardworking a guy as you'd want to see, who has been indexing and book after book after book. So if you want to find out about an effect you'd like to do, for a talk I gave a week or so ago, I was interested in finding out things about the slow motion four ace routine. Well, he's got two sites. One's called Conjuring Archive and the other is called Conjuring Credits. Mm-hmm. And in both those places, you can find tons of resources. And if you're a member of a fabulous site like Ask Alexander, you can actually research this stuff. And it's an important thing to do when you're working on a trick. So no, I say there's no excuse to not crediting when a credit is available. And if somebody wants to skip it, okay, fine. That is actually their loss. But for the people for whom crediting is important, which is people like me, if you take the time to do that, then when I read your book, I go, ah, there's a true student of magic. There's somebody who has done the work. And you go up in my estimation.
Ah, good point. I understand. Speaking of which, and going back to music, I kind of want to backtrack a little bit and going back to kind of where we first met when I saw you. And I don't remember, this may have been Evansville, Indiana. In fact, I think it was the year when that Lance Burton had won the first gold medal with his Dove
Act. Yes, sir.
And I don't remember if you were competing or you were performing, but I remember I thought you were playing the piano and you had like Kermit the Frog kind of a thing with the little...
Yeah, I did. And I think that was the second time that the IBM was in Evansville. First time was in 76. And in 1980, I was hired to bring my trio down. I was working with a jazz trio at the time. Mm-hmm. And we served as the band for the cabaret shows. And the cabaret shows were Jay Marshall, Patrick and Mia, me, I think I did something besides playing, and somebody else. And I don't remember who that was. But I remember several things about that convention. One is that it rained constantly and the hotel smelled like a swamp.
It was
just a mess. I've never forgotten that. The other thing I've never forgotten is the cabaret shows were at 11 a.m. And Jay Marshall's introduction to me was, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jay Marshall, one of the better, cheaper acts. We are delighted to have with us this morning Mike Close and the trio. And we're happy that they're here because they normally don't stop puking till noon. So that was Jay's introduction of me. The other memorable thing about that was Blackstone Senior's wife or ex-wife, Inez Blackstone, was at that convention, and she yelled at us for being too loud. And it was an unmiked grand piano, acoustic bass, and drums, and we were too loud. So that's the way it goes. We would have gotten off her lawn if we knew where her lawn was and gotten on it just so we could get off of it. So anyway, so we got yelled at by her.
But I remember.
But yes, I believe that's where we met.
Yes. There was somebody else, but you weren't in the competition. You were actually one of the performers then.
Yeah. I've only competed in any contest, I think, three times in my life. One was the first Lion's Head Siegfried and Roy trophy thing that Joe Stevens did in Las Vegas, which I want to say is 1980, but may well have been 1981. Mm-hmm. Richard Turner won that one.
And I have known guy.
Yeah, I have photos of that. And I have stories about that. If you want to go that route,
I would like to hear a story about that. Yeah.
Several things came from that particular convention. One was that it was the first time Joe had tried to organize a contest, and basically everybody who was in the contest performed, and then they collected all the ballots, which was basically a people's choice thing.
Right.
And maybe the seven highest votes competed again then for the grand main prize. But the problem was we had to perform again, which meant that everybody was seeing the same tricks that they had seen the day before. And we were being judged on that. We were being graded on that, which is an impossible situation. It's impossible for that to be fair in any sense of the thing. And the only person who really could do that without losing any effectiveness is Richard Turner, because he didn't do any magic. All he did was demonstrate his tremendous skill.
Yeah.
And seeing someone do that fabulous stuff twice doesn't diminish how astonishing it is that he has that much ability. And he won. Now, I don't know. That's here, there, anywhere. But I thought that was a weird thing. However, it did lead to an invention of a trick that I published called Dancers at the End of Time. And I came up with it like the night before, simply because I desperately thought I better put in at least one trick that they hadn't seen the last time I worked. So that was basically that convention. Go ahead.
I was about to say, I recall also that Michael Weber had competed, and what was memorable about that was when he was doing a $100 bill switch, when he borrowed someone's one and then changed to 100 and then handed it back out. And people would say, well, here, I'll give you that back. I said, no, I can do that anytime. And because if you have the skill, you should be able to do that. That
exactly.
was memorable. And so if you had to do that two times, I could see why that could be expensive.
Well, that was not the same year. Weber okay. was in that contest, however. Weber was in that contest. But it was a couple years later when Weber came up with that idea. And actually, what made it brilliant was the spectator had memorized the serial number on his dollar bill, you know, before Weber changed it. The serial number matched, and Weber says, well, you know, basically here's what he did that was so fantastic. He did what anyone would do if they had the power of a real magician. If you can do that, that's what you do. You
sure.
change a 1 to 100 and you give it back to the guy. It's no big deal. You can do it anytime
deal.
You want.
Right.
So that was a brilliant, brilliant thing. The second time I competed was when Joe held an impromptu magic contest. And that was a lot of fun. It had almost nothing to do with impromptu because I remember that I forget who was in charge of the contest. It might have been Bill Wells who was talking us through what had to happen. And he brought all the competitors into a room and he showed us a two-top restaurant table set for dinner. And he basically said, this is what you will see when you come into the performance area to compete, and you can use any prop that's on the table, anything that's there. And I remember when Bill left and the competitors left, and I looked back at the table and there wasn't anything left on the table. So all the guys just grabbed whatever they thought they could gaff up
yeah.
and take back to the room with them. So that was the impromptu thing. And the final time I competed, and which basically drove home the point that I will never compete again, was at one of Rich Block's Washington conventions.
Yeah, the summit.
Mm-hmm. And he had made a really bad mistake, which was that the young people who were competing, the minors, let's say, were competing for the same prizes as the adults. There wasn't a young person division and an adult division. And what happened was that the kids who were competing were great, really skillful young people who had mentors who had shown them some really great stuff. So the judges are judging on a scale of 1 to 10. Well, what are you going to do when a kid comes up and does coins and cylinder or something like that? You're going to give that kid a really high mark, which leaves no headroom when the adults come in to compete.
Sure.
And the most embarrassing thing to me, I'll share this story. I think it's hilarious. It puts me in an incredibly crappy light. But none of us who were competing knew that this was going to be the case, that we were competing against kids. So I competed, and when they announced the winners, they said that the difference between first and second place was like 0.05 or something like that. Just this hair's sliver of a point difference. So they announced first runner up and the second runner up and the first runner up, mm-hmm. and they were both young kids. And the winner was Mike Close. And all of a sudden, the way that comes out, it makes me look like an idiot. And I certainly,
you can beat a seventh grader.
It was the fastest acceptance I think of anyone's ever done of a prize. I ran up and went, thanks, sat back down. And then, of course, to my dismay, Williamson was the master of ceremonies for the show. And he says, oh, wow, what a contest. That's so great. He says, the only thing I ever competed in was an essay contest when I was in fourth grade. Mike Close won.
That's a good
one. So I had a hard time living that down. But so that's my contest experience.
Well, then after that, I know that, in fact, you and I had served, I think, together as well and judging some of the contests. You know, after that. Now, this goes back to a little bit of what we were talking about as far as being a reviewer in a magazine or online or whatever of tricks, because it is art is hard to judge. You know, I started out in college actually as an art major and then went into journalism thinking I was going to be an art critic. Well, ultimately, I was writing about conventions and that I think that it's in the eye of the beholder, you know, what that you enjoy, but someone else may not like. So, when you and I had judged, it seems like you and I were talking one time whenever that Giovanni Lavera had won, and there was some controversy at the time in which that it looked like what he was doing was not something that he could do like table hopping because he had all these big props, and you were saying that's really more of a parlor show rather than a close-up show. Do you remember that?
I remember it like it was yesterday, Scott, because I've actually never forgiven you. Or the people who were involved with the judging for that.
That's why I like to bring that up, you know, just rub some more
salt. Well, I mean, I can tell the story. Maybe I shouldn't.
No, but I do want to hear your perspective. Here we go.
Well, my perspective is this. What is good magic and what magicians will respond to because they think it's fun are two different things. Mm-hmm. It is my opinion, for which I have no hard facts other than seeing it happen as it happens at conventions, is that magicians respond most vocally with gasps and applause to that which they can understand immediately how the thing was accomplished, but they can pretend that they can also do that as well. That means that if someone comes on to compete and deeply fools, I mean deeply fools an audience of magicians, mm-hmm. the reaction from the crowd will not be the same as somebody who produces a large object from either his lap or from behind a table. Now, my point was that we've taken a technique that started with Bosco back in the late 1700s, something like that. Bosco standing behind a draped table pulling doves out. Mm-hmm. And have said that in the 20th century, that in some way this moves magic forward. Well, so people who do that kind of thing, an example is Johnny Ace Palmer's act, are rewarded by getting a very high prize. Well, how does this affect the world of magic? It affects it in this way. The kids who want to compete look at the acts who have won.
Right.
And they say, well, if that won, I'm going to do something like that. Mm-hmm. And from that moment on, magic does not move forward. Magic moves horizontally or begins to fade backwards. And you could certainly list for me, because your memory is probably better on this, the number of acts who were rewarded with medals, gold cups, FISM prizes, what have you, by simply pulling a large object out from behind a draped surface. Mm-hmm. It happens over and over again. I don't see the point. I don't see that the contest in that way moves magic forward. So consequently, when you and I discussed the Giovanni decision and you explained to me why you felt that this was okay to present this award to him for that particular act, and I won't go into the reasoning behind it, but I will say I said to you, I think that's the worst reason I've ever heard in my entire life. And if I were you, I would never tell anyone that that was the reason. And now we have. But perhaps enough years have passed that, and I'll tell you the truth. After that convention, because that was the 91 convention in Baltimore, mm-hmm. where Giovanni competed, I basically had to talk one of the competitors off the ledge simply because he had done an act that did move magic forward in particular ways with tremendous skill. And somehow he got beat by an act where somebody pulled something out from behind a great table. Now, this is why, and I think this is the important part, before anybody just goes, well, I hate Mike Close for even expressing that opinion. I think it points out what's the problem with contest acts and convention acts in general, especially in terms of the bragging rights that someone uses from that point forward. You have to remember that you've won that prize due to the opinions of a bunch of judges of whom I don't know who they are, nor can I competently rate their qualifications. Mm-hmm. And it also means you were the best one of the people who competed on that day. Right. Now, of course, some conventions, and I think this is really important, some judging is done on an ideal scale. So it isn't that we have to award big prizes for something. If the point total doesn't reach that level, then that's not awarded. But I do think it's important to keep that perspective in mind when it comes to bragging rights and ego.
Well, as far as moving magic in one direction or another, the exception I would take is that I don't think there's anything wrong with that. When someone sees something that had won 1 year, they might go that direction. I remember competing 1 year, and I lost to this magician from Mexico City who had great skill. And so the next year I competed and I worked on some things that were technically difficult and entertaining. And there was a guy who told mostly jokes and he won. And so, it goes in a different direction, but my point I was going to say is let's look at people who become clones of others. I mean, certainly that Lance Burton set a direction for a generation that seems like a magician. It's like, I want to be like him, like David Copperfield or Doug Henning or whoever happens to be really popular and has won the hearts of the general public at that time, that kind of moves magic in this direction. I think just like art, whether there have been impressionists or realists, or, they kind of all, and this is like all that generation will start saying, okay, well, he was popular, I'm going to kind of do this. And they will kind of morph from one thing to another. And it's a pendulum that kind of goes back and forth. So the fact that he had done something different from what other magicians had been doing was maybe what moved that direction, was like, to producing these large things from behind the table. We haven't done that in years. And so let's move that direction.
Well, once again, the question is, What are you trying to say? Why are you doing this at all? I mean, certainly it doesn't do anybody any good at all to say, I want to paint like Picasso. Picasso's done that, mm-hmm. and he's done it so much better than you're ever going to do it. Or I want to write like Beethoven. Well, fine, but Beethoven's already done it better than you have. And Brahms also gave it a stab, and he's not that far away, and he's great. So I think it's important to look what has happened in the past, yes. But if you don't have a clear direction of what it is you're trying to convey with your magic and what you're trying to say, and you run into the problem, I wanted to throw this out and make sure it gets on the air, is that there have been occasions in magic judging where the judges were completely off base. And the two examples I would give would be Tom Mullica and Leonard Green, easily two of the greatest magicians of the 20th and 21st centuries. Mm-hmm. And with Mullica, he fooled the judges so completely that at least one judge thought he was just a geek eating cigarettes.
Yeah.
And with Leonard, because his techniques were so radically new, they thought he was using trick cards, which when you compete in the card part of FISM, you're not allowed to do.
Right.
So it depends a lot on who's judging but then again, by the same token, Mullica is Mullica. No one will ever be Mullica. Mm-hmm. Leonard Green is Leonard Green. And of course, Danny D'Ortiz has adopted many of Leonard's kind of mannerisms, but he also brings a lot of Tamari's influence in there. And also he's just Danny Ortiz.
Yes.
He sort of synthesized these two things into his own original approach. But I'm sure Danny is in a position of now being an influencer for lots of young card guys.
Correct.
So I just think that it's important to keep the competition thing in perspective, to understand that what it's really great for, if you have a top-notch act, number one, if you win a contest or if you place high, the probability is, if you're somebody that nobody's heard of, you're going to probably be booked to work a lot of conventions, assuming that conventions actually exist again after we get through this situation. And it can make you known around the world, which is a lovely thing, as long as I think you keep it in perspective with the way, you know, the way things work. And now, you know, now we're in another situation where the table now has served a different purpose. The table isn't there to hide the big thing that you're going to produce, but the mechanics built into the table become a big part of why the act is successful. Now that's the trend.
That's true. And I mean, you look at America's Got Talent, there have been a lot of really, you know, high-tech tables.
Oh, and that's a great thing, because if you can't make the gig, you can just send the table. And the table won't get COVID-19, so it's probably even your safest bet right now.
Kind of like Del Rey, who used to have a wonderful table.
Yep.
So, in other words, if guys who are doing it now are not the first necessarily to do that, you know, then either.
Nor are they the best. Nor are they the best. I mean, yeah. Del was a force of nature. I mean, he was, and the thing that's most interesting about Del was that really his tech was actually cutting edge at the time he was doing it.
Yeah.
It seems like silly stuff now, but it was pretty much cutting edge things. And again, he was such a strong performer, and he didn't need the table. I mean, he really didn't need the table. He could kill you without the table.
Just waiting but on you, Willie.
Yeah, exactly. Just a marvelous performer.
Yeah, he really was. And whenever that he would have the performance, I know that he would have the room shut off. You couldn't get in there because he was getting the tables and the chair and everything, you know, situated for optimum viewing. And yeah, it was wonderful. And I recommend John Mooring's wonderful book on him if you have
absolutely.
A chance to read. Mm-hmm. One of the best, one of the better ones. I want to go back in history a little bit then also, back in Carmel, Indiana. That was right outside Cincinnati, is that right?
No, just north of Indianapolis.
Indianapolis, pardon me. And so you were performing there, and along with Chris Kenner and Carl Andrews, and I don't remember who all else was there with you way back. And
yeah,
what years were that?
The way that worked was I had actually dropped out of Magic from 1984 to Illusions, when Illusions opened, which was in the summer, I think June of 1988.
You know, that was, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's what I was about to say earlier, is that whenever I saw you on the scene, basically, you know, when we first met in Evansville, and then again you were in Vegas and at the Joe Stevens seminars, that all of a sudden you dropped out of Magic, and then you were doing more music at that time, and I thought, where'd this guy go? Because he was making a huge mark, and then you were just like gone, you know, completely. So I'm glad you came back.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, I would take the phrase making a mark with a grain of salt, only that I was showing up at conventions, and I was working conventions, and I was doing stuff that guys hadn't seen, and stuff that guys couldn't exactly figure out.
Yeah, like your memorized deck, first time I'd ever seen that.
Yeah, but see, that was later.
That was years later. I guess that's true.
Yeah, I mean, Memdeck didn't come into my life as a performance tool until 1990. So, you know, I was doing the stuff. I was working at a restaurant. I was working at a Max and Irma's restaurant in Indianapolis, and that was a steady gig for me from 1978 to 1984. And I had always felt, and I had mentioned this on my live video a couple of days ago, I always put Magic aside for a period of time because Magic is a little crazy, and the people in it can be some of the best people I've ever known in my life, and some that I'm so happy are old and deep friends of mine, some creative, brilliant people. But Magic is also filled with an outstandingly large number of jerks. And so dealing with the unpleasant side of Magic, you can get worn out. You can get frustrated. You can get kind of weary dealing with the limitations in Magic. Whereas for me, music has always been kind of a wide open thing, much more variety, much more chances to express yourself in a particularly personal way. So in 1984, I turned over the Max and Irma's gig to a friend of mine named Mark Lehman, who actually ended up being there for more than 20 years. He did that gig for a long, long time. And I just devoted myself to my music career because I was being hired to do studio work. I was working with a very fine band that did, I mean, when you say wedding reception band, it sounds like it's a negative thing. But these are some of the best players I've ever worked with in my life, and they were really doing a wonderful job doing live playing. And I ended up being in, you know, doing pit orchestra things for touring Broadway musical shows. I would do that. I did a lot of recording work, much of it for a guy named Bill Gaither, who's a gospel singer who has a studio in Alexandria, Indiana. Played on some Sandy Patty stuff. Did a lot of the music for Disney on Ice, which was taped in Indianapolis. And so I was really happy doing that, and I just put magic aside. I said, you know, I've been performing this now for 8 years, or 6 years, I guess, what was it, 78? Yeah, 6 years. I need to give it a little bit of a breather. And so when I got hired for magic conventions, many times it was for the music aspect. I told the story, I think yesterday, of being hired for the 85 IBM convention and working with Chuck Byrd and the Harry Blackstone show. And that was sort of the way I started being the music director for the evening shows at the IBM. Was there a question? If so, I just blew by.
No, we were just talking about, you know, the people who were involved in working there at Illusions.
Oh, yes. So Illusions started in June of 88, and Carl Andrews was involved with it then and asked if, you know, they needed magicians, because the way Illusions was designed, a lot of people were going to come through and every table got magic. So especially on weekends, they needed a lot of magicians. And I thought, well, you know, I put this aside for a long time. I'll go in, I'll say yes, and I'll do it. And if I am not having any fun, I'll say I don't want to do this anymore. So I ended up having fun doing it. And one of the things that really made it fun was that Illusions eliminated one of the huge problems of doing magic in a restaurant. Because at Illusions, when you walked in the door, you knew what you were getting into. You were going to have dinner at a magic-themed restaurant, and there would be magic involved. It's like working the Magic Castle. People who go to the Magic Castle are going there because they want to see magic. So you don't have that initial conflict fight of somebody who doesn't really care to watch magic tricks, and you're in a restaurant walking up to a table, and you've either got to deal with them somehow in that situation. And that was a wonderful thing.
Yeah, like if you're going to a restaurant called Mariachi's, you expect to be approached by mariachis.
But... Exactly. So that was great fun. And about, I guess about 3 months into it, Carl Andrews left. And they made me the supervisor of the magic staff. And I sort of did that for 5 years. The restaurant went through some, in my opinion, extremely negative, phases, mainly by really, 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 bad decisions. And it just wasn't fun for me anymore. So I left in 1993. So I was there for 5 years. Now, during the 5 years, I will tell you that I would have put Illusions up against the Magic Castle any night of the week.
Who all did you have there?
Huh?
Who all did you have there that worked there?
The base crew was me, Chris Moore, who was the manager of the restaurant, who came from Florida at a place called the Magic Moment, and a guy named Dan Daggert. And Daggert was also from Florida and had worked at the Magic Moment, and he moved up to Indianapolis to be there. Steve Hart was a part of the original crew. Mark Brandeberry, a fine performer from Lafayette, Indiana. I know I'm leaving guys out, and forgive me, guys, if I forgot your name. But that was basically kind of the core group that was
there. And
Chris
Kanner? Didn't Chris work there?
Yeah, but not at the beginning.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah, Chris was there. Chris came in. When we first opened, they were bringing in acts to do a stand-up show in the bar. And the problem is, it costs a lot of money to bring somebody in from out of town and put them up and give them a per diem and then pay them as well. But there is no real name recognition to the general public to close-up or parlor magicians.
Right.
What just wasn't the same back then.
Right.
Which meant that If we bring in Dan Garrett, well, Dan Garrett is a sensationally great magician and really a fine performer and entertaining as hell.
Right.
But nobody in Indianapolis is going to come to Illusions on a Friday or Saturday to see Dan Garrett.
Mm-hmm. That isn't have going a to be the celebrity name. You need to have
somebody. Yeah, exactly. So it ended up being not cost efficient to be bringing in out of town people. But while we were bringing people in, Chris Kenner came in and worked the lounge and then decided he liked the environment there so much that he moved to Indianapolis and began to work there. And then Homer Leewag came over from Cincinnati and he joined the staff. So really, between Kenner and Homer and guys like Brandeberry and Steve Hart and guys who were really entertaining and doing strong stuff, I'll add me to that mix. The thing about the Magic Castle is, as wonderful as the Magic Castle is, how great the magic you see is really depends on whoever has been hired for that particular week.
That week.
And certainly, you will see some world-class magic at the Magic Castle. But there are nights you will go there and maybe you don't see world-class magic. It's a reality. It depends on who's booked. But at Illusions, we had consistency. You were guaranteed to come in, and especially if you were a magician, there was somebody who was going to kick your ass that night. Somebody was going to show you something that you hadn't seen before. And that's what I really liked about Illusions. And Chris and Homer were there till about, 91 or 92 when they made contact with Copperfield and moved off to do that show.
And when was it then that you had moved from there to Las Vegas and started working there at Blackstone Bar?
I was in Indianapolis until 1998. I moved to Vegas in February of 98 and was immediately struck by how profoundly difficult it was to try to get any work there.
As a magician?
Absolutely. And as a musician as well.
Oh.
I joined the musicians union. I didn't really join. I transferred my membership to the Las Vegas local. And I figured, so I said, so what's the waiting period? Because normally when you join a union like that from a different place, you can't just immediately jump into working.
Yeah.
Because they figure you're taking work away from a longer term member. And they said, you know, hop in the pool, man. Just go for it. Whatever you can get. But it was enormously difficult to get work. And one of the big problems was just the rapid turnover of entertainment directors. I remember Lisa and I got there to Vegas in February of 98. And in September of 98, we went on this 90-day, 60-city lecture tour. But before we left, I had sent out my promotional package to every entertainment director in every casino in Las Vegas, a huge expense duplicating tape, because that's what it was back then.
Sure.
Tape and what have you. And got no responses from anybody. So then we left on this tour and came back in December.
Which,
and
by the way,
January,
hold that thought, because I remember your lecture tour being completely different from any lecture that I had seen prior nor since, in which you had your own PowerPoint presentation, brought your stuff with you that you had shown with that. Wasn't that right?
Yeah, but that was not that year. That was
okay, it's later.
That was a little later on.
Okay.
We didn't have that technology then.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. That was the second one we did, which was like 2005, I guess. We went on again. Anyway, we got back to Vegas in December, late December of 1998. And in January of 99, I started calling all the entertainment directors that I had sent these packages to. And most of them were gone. They'd been replaced with other people just in the time that I had been gone.
Hmm.
So, and it took me a long time to get hired to do the Houdini Lounge gig. And that was mainly because, for some reason, when I talked to the entertainment director there, he said there will only be one magician in the Monte Carlo, and that magician is Lance Burton. And I said, but do you understand that I'm not doing what Lance is doing? Mine is a very small show. I'm combining it with piano playing. And I can promote Lance's show to the people who come into the bar. There will only be one magician in the Monte Carlo. So that I'm bouncing up against that. And
yeah.
Finally, I did the one thing that I was trying not to do. I called Lance.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, hey, do you know the entertainment guy? And he says, no. I said, you don't know them? He says, I don't even bother to learn their names. They're gone so fast.
They rotate so quickly.
Yeah. And I said to him, well, look, here's what I'm pitching to them. And here's what they are telling me. Could you call this guy and tell him that you understand that I'm not your competition in this and that it's okay to have another magician in the Monte Carlo? Sure, I'd be glad to. The very next day, I get a call from the entertainment director. Mike, come on in. Let's talk. So that's how I got the Monte Carlo gig. And it was in a room called the Houdini Lounge. The Blackstone restaurant was next door to the Houdini Lounge.
Okay, so, that was why I was confusing that way.
Yeah. But I will tell you something about that gig. During the 3 years I worked there, not a single person responsible for signing my check ever saw me do a trick or heard me play a note. They never came in. They never talked to me. They never contacted me. Huh. But what I did was every table I worked, I gave them a Monte Carlo comment card. And I said, here's how you can evaluate your experience here at the beautiful resort. And here where it says other comments is where you write wonderful magician. Michael was a wonderful magician. They said, oh, we'll definitely do that. And I know they did. By the time they fired me from that place, and incidentally, I was never told why I was fired. I was simply called and said, don't bother to come in.
Wow. So somebody like the next day? You mean like overnight, basically?
Oh, yeah. One day I had a job. The next day I didn't have a job without having any idea why I no longer had a job. But I do know that there were comment cards that must have gone from floor to ceiling twice in the general manager's office if you kept that kind of thing. So that's the way Vegas is. I guess that answered that question.
Well, no. Yeah, that does. And so eventually that kind of you'd met a lot of the local magicians who were there, and you'd known Johnny Thompson, I guess, for a long number of years.
Yes.
Up to that point.
I met Johnny in 76, and Harry Reiser called me and said, hey, Johnny Thompson's coming through town. He's driving on his way back east. Do you want to meet Johnny Thompson? I said, hell yes, I want to meet Johnny Thompson. It's very possible I had seen Johnny before that, you know, doing something, but we didn't really know each other. And that's where I first met Johnny and Pam and got to know them a little bit. And over the years, we just grew closer and closer. Because Harry Reiser was Johnny's mentor, even though Harry and Johnny were much closer in age.
Harry was your mentor and friend, too, wasn't he?
Absolutely. Absolutely was. And I think this is why Johnny and I hit it off so well, is because we had the same training, basically. We had the same person that we looked up to. Johnny, of course, also had the benefit of being around Vernon a lot and Charlie Miller. But, of course, so did Harry. Harry was, you know, Charlie Miller lived at Harry's house.
Yeah.
And Vernon, you know, stayed at Harry's house. So anyway, we both had the same aesthetic, for lack of a better word, about what we thought magic should look like. So when I got out to Vegas in 98 and basically had settled down because I was there for a while and then Lisa and I left on this 3-month lecture tour. But Johnny brought me in to work with Penn and Teller on the bits that they, you know, were working on for the stage show. So I did that from about the early 1999 up until 2010, I guess, when we left and moved back east. And it was a fantastic experience. I can't compliment Penn and Teller enough about how great they are to work with, because all they are interested in is how can we make this the best it can be? Mm-hmm. Sometimes if you go to a magician who's working on a thing and you say, you know, you flashed, well, people don't see that thing. You know, that was a fluke. People don't see it. If, you know, when we put a trick into the show, Johnny and I would sit at the far extremes of the audience to make sure all the angles and everything were good. And if one of us said to Penn and Teller, you know, that angle's no good here, it flashes, their first response is, how do we fix it? That's it. How do we fix it? How do we make this?
They don't try to defend it. They recognize that
there's no defense. Mm-hmm. There's no defense. The only question is, how do we make this as good as we can possibly make this? So while I was out there, I mean, my fingerprints are all over the cell phone trick in the fish, TSA, where the girl is produced from the scanning machine. I was there at the early development of the vanishing cow, or the vanishing elephant, I should say. Just lots and lots and lots of stuff. And so I understand how they work. I understand how to pitch things to them. I understand what they're looking for. And so when Fool Us came back, I mean, the first season was in England in, I think, 2011. I was not involved with that. But when it was picked up later by the CW network and we started to do them in Las Vegas on season two, Johnny immediately pitched me to the producers and to Penn and Teller to come out as being the second magic consultant on the thing. And that's, I've been there ever since.
Have you had other consultants who have assisted the two of you guys over the years?
Well, I'm sure Penn and Teller have.
But I mean, as far as the show, as the Fool Us show.
No, Johnny and I are the consultants. Now, some of the acts do hire on their own somebody to work with them in preparation for the show. But that is completely outside of the Fool Us production staff. Mm-hmm. And
What would be one of the most technically difficult presentations that you have put on stage or you've seen somebody perform there on the Fool Us over the years?
Technically difficult?
Yeah. And I'm not necessarily talking about sleight of hand technically. I mean, it could be because of the logistics of getting them there or preparing and getting the lighting or the camera, you know, being the right position or whatever that it happens to be. I mean,
well, you know, I don't know if there's any that we looked at. I mean, we run up against two different situations. One is that the act is very, very big, and the other is that the act is very, very small.
Hmm.
I remember the year that the fellow named Jabrizi was on, whose big trick was putting, you know, the dime into the sugar packet, that Dennis Rosenblatt, our director, who is just a man whose knowledge of the job is incredibly deep, and I learn from him every time we do a show because I'm learning more and more about the demands of television and what it takes to make good television. But he was complaining about the fact of how in the world is he going to shoot this teeny tiny thing? And why are we, I say we, but why are they, the producers and the network, hiring guys doing such small stuff? And then the next thing he had to shoot a day or so after that was Greg Fruin, who brought in an illusion that basically stretched the length of the Penn and Teller stage. It's the biggest damn illusion I've ever seen.
Wow.
And so that presented its own challenges. So, I've always said to guys, when you're thinking about being on Fool Us, if there's another season, that you really need to think about how you're going to make that work on that big stage. There is no proscenium, which means that there is no easy way to get anything on stage or off stage. Hmm. You can't instantly go into the audience to deal with a volunteer because the closest person is 25 feet away easily. And even when you walk to the edge of the stage, there's still, 5 feet away sitting in the first row.
And that's so filmed in the Penn and Teller Theater there?
Yes, it is.
At the Rio?
The transformation of the Penn and Teller stage into the Fool Us set is one of the great magic tricks that happens every year that we do the show. It's just remarkable to see.
And when you record that, I assume that just happens over, a three-week period or something?
Oh, God, if it was only a three-week period, that would be lovely.
Okay.
We shoot 62 magicians and 13 Penn and Teller tricks in 2 weeks of residency in the Penn and Teller Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't even two full weeks of shows.
Do they close down the theater to the public during that time?
Indeed, they do. Yes, they do. Mm-hmm. Yes, they do. Because there would be no way to do the Penn and Teller show because, for example, that runway that leads out to the little circular area where Penn and Teller sit, that doesn't exist in the Penn and Teller Theater the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes out the entire center section of seats.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the challenges. I mean, the challenges of doing that kind of show is you get very big, you get very small. I know one of the acts that we videoed, what's the 21st century term for the way we digitized?
You recorded.
Yeah, we recorded it. But we didn't. It's not going to be a record, but it was recorded.
Yeah.
The method that this fella had designed for this trick, which would work just about in any other stage, it works perfectly on the stage of the Magic Castle, but his method does not work at all on the Penn and Teller stage. And so he literally had to talk to people and get another prop designed so that they could do this trick on the Penn and Teller stage. So there's all that kind of stuff that goes on. What most people don't know about the show is I started work on the show in October of last year. And the producers receive videos from acts who submit them from around the world.
Yeah.
And they make their preliminary choices and they send those to me. And I write my analysis of those acts and talk about things that maybe have concerns of method or presentation or how are we going to do this on our stage, that kind of thing. And then once an act is booked for the show, I try to work with them via Skype or email or on the phone or whatever, because if there's things that I think need to be fixed, and of course, what I think needs to be fixed simply comes from the way that I look at magic. And I think it's a good way to look at magic because I think the stuff that's on Fool Us is as strong as it's been on television at all in the last, at least the last decade, probably the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to get all that stuff solved before we get out to Vegas because it is a completely brutal schedule. The second week of taping, I'm up at 7. Usually I'm out of the room almost at 7 a.m. to get some breakfast, and I don't get back to the room till 11 o'clock at night. And we do that 4 days straight.
How many?
So
4 days straight?
But that's the second week. We've already done close to that the first week.
Mm-hmm.
So it just gets – and I don't have a break. I don't have a day off in those 2 weeks.
So when people are going to be sending in videos to you, they are unsolicited, but are there times which that you are saying, hey, I have seen this guy or somebody or lady to do this trick, and you solicit them saying, would you be interested in coming and performing that on the show?
Yeah, it goes both ways.
Okay.
I try to twist the arms of my friends who I know are excellent performers and who do tricks that I think would look great on television. Sometimes I'm successful in twisting an arm. Sometimes I'm not successful.
Mm-hmm.
I twisted Tom Stone's arm for, I don't know, months, I guess, trying to get him to come on the show. And I'm glad he did because his trick with the boxes is just a fabulous piece of magic. You know, the fact that it didn't fool Penn and Teller had nothing to do with the quality of the effect. I thought it was going to fool Penn and Teller. I just had never realized or never known how much Teller knew about drawer boxes. I mean, it's unbelievable what he knows.
Do you have a lot of autonomy as to who that you're going to be having on there, or do the producers, directors, the television network executives have the final say? In other words, that if there is someone who – I remember, for example, that Paul Gertner was saying how that he was not going to be coming on because he didn't meet the demographic. He was a little bit older. They were looking for somebody younger, but he was the one who had invented this, so you did have him come in. So my question is, do you have someone you report to, or they pretty much give you free rein to whoever you want to bring on?
No. The hiring and not hiring power lies solely with the executive producers and the network.
Okay.
All I can do is suggest, and there are times when I try to suggest as fervently as I possibly can. In the case of Paul and the unshuffled routine, that one, Johnny was still alive at that time, and that one worked. And basically, the fellow who had submitted the trick is a friend of Paul's. He knows Paul that it wasn't done,
mm-hmm.
you know, and after all, Paul had published the effect. But when a guy comes on the show or auditions for the show and does a published, trick,
yeah.
I always say to the producers, wouldn't it be better since this person has not substantially changed this trick one iota? Wouldn't it be better to have the guy who invented it come on the show and do it? And sometimes sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't work. So, but the one thing I do try to emphasize to the magicians is I have no hiring or not hiring power on that show. I can only suggest.
Mm-hmm.
My function is to take the acts that are booked and however I can, in whatever way I can, with whatever positive suggestions I can possibly come up with to make that as perfect a hunk of magic as it could possibly be on television.
on a final note on the subject on Foulis, who is it that has now filled in for Johnny since he's passed?
Nobody.
Just you, basically. You're the main and only.
It's just me. I'm the guy. Okay. I'm the guy now.
And I hope you stay healthy.
Well,
you're doing a good job.
Well, thank you, and I hope you. I hope you wish me well, not just for Fool Us, but for my family. But
well, of course.
I'll take that with a grain of salt, Scott. Hey, don't die. You're going to ruin the show. Okay, I'll stick around.
You need to, exactly. So you're saying that from year to year, like, again, you've just wrapped this. Was it this fifth or sixth season?
No, believe it or not, this is season seven.
Seven, okay.
Yeah.
And so you won't know until at the end of this run whether or not that the numbers were good enough and the executives say, let's do it again?
Generally speaking, that is the case. Okay. We find out how the ratings do. The network decides whether or not there will be a season eight. The producers are optimistic that there will be a season eight, but really until that contract is inked, it's really premature to do anything other than to be thinking about what you want to do on Fool Us.
Sure.
And I spoke a little bit about in my broadcast today about some of the things that are really important for thinking about when you want to, you know, put a trick on Fool Us.
And those things quickly are what?
Say again?
I said quickly, can you run through those real that you
were
talking about?
Well, here's what we really have to think about. What you want is, I guess let me go back and preface this way. The idea of getting on the show and fooling Penn and Teller, that's the thing that got the show on the air. That's not the thing that's important. That's really not the thing that's important. Now, it's easy for me to say that, but I do understand the ego of magicians.
Yeah.
And that if you have a reputation as being a magician who can fool people, and if you go on Penn and Teller Fool Us and you don't fool somebody, then in some way you failed in that attempt.
Hmm.
And it's like I said to all the guys in the little pep talk that we have before we start taping a show. And remind me if I don't say it, but ask me about how we do a show, because that's important for people to know. But anyway, I said to them, look, you have been hired to be on this show. You have already won. It is possible that as a cherry on that cake, you will get a cheap plastic trophy. But that's not the reason that you've won. You've won because you're here, and that's important. So the main thing for people to consider when they're going to come on the show is don't come up with some convoluted card trick that, you know, I've got to follow 59 procedures to figure out how it is you found my card, because that doesn't make entertaining television. The first thing you have to think about is this a trick that will engage the viewers at home and keep them from changing channels while you're in the middle of it? That's an important thing.
Good point. Yeah, sure.
If your goal is to fool Penn and Teller, then you should come up with a trick that will fool me.
Mm-hmm.
Because just about, with the exception of Tom Stone's trick and a few others, if an act comes on Penn and Teller, if I look at an act and in my analysis I say, I'm not exactly sure how this works, there's a very good potential that it's going to fool Penn and Teller. But the main consideration is the effect should be clean and clear. It should be engaging. It should be entertaining. You should have done it 1,000 times in front of people so that you've hammered out all the presentational things. Because this Fool Us is not standing at home in front of your laptop and putting a trick on YouTube. It's not that.
Good
point. There are people watching at home who have the method of escaping your performance that's a quarter inch away from their forefinger. And all they have to do is change the channel. So if you go back and you see all the stuff we've done on Fool Us, you'll find out we're top heavy with card tricks, just the nature of magic. Mm-hmm. If you do a non-card item, that's a good thing. Think about visibility. Think about how in the world does this get shot on a huge stage? Think about if you need volunteers. Think about if Penn and Teller could be part of the action and be up there watching it, which is always good. Because think about it. Do you want a promo video with Joe Schmo and his wife from, Mesquite in the audience coming up on stage? Or do you want Penn and Teller up on stage helping you? Well, you want Penn and Teller. The problem is, if they get up there on top of you, you better have a good trick.
Because they're watching really close at that point, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'll tell you, Teller pretty much starts to analyze and break down the trick the minute they start to move the props on stage.
Hmm.
It's crazy, because I'm listening to him, so I hear that. So I wanted to mention about how we shoot the show.
Yeah, yeah.
The show is done in a modular way. In other words, we record the people as they are available to be in Las Vegas. So we might do a show with six guys on it, and maybe they all do card tricks. Well, that isn't going to be an episode of Fool Us, because they're going to mix and match modularly the acts to make a variety show out of it. This is why Penn and Teller and Allison all wear identical clothes on every show, because that's the way we shoot it.
Oh, okay.
So, and that's important. I mean, I was just, you know, it just kills me the number of people who get on internet forums and complain about the fact that Allison wears the same outfit all the time. And I say, hey, Jonathan Ross wore the same black suit every single show. Penn and Teller wear the same suits. You're not bitching about them. Why are you getting on her case? Okay. Oh, that's right. You're a sexist pig. I'd forgotten that point. So that's why it's done that way. That's why that's important.
There you go. Well, listen, as we start to conclude, there were a couple of things that I mentioned at the top of this, and also that you have one or two, I think, CDs that are out of your music. I think you get a holiday music and then another one with the jazz trio. Or is that right?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you remember those. Those aren't available anymore, for that. Those were done with the technology that was available 25 years ago, I guess, mm-hmm. and I'm sad to say they don't really hold up. What I'm thinking of doing is actually setting up my phone and just doing some recording of me just playing some tunes on the piano here in the house.
Yeah,
the piano's a little out of tune. And the only reason I'm reluctant to do it is my own personal stringent requirements of quality. And, you know, I practice some and I play some. But I'm not guaranteed of a flawless performance, which sort of in my head is really what I need to be doing.
Right.
So if I can sort of get past that mental block, I'll start putting some music up on my Facebook page so everybody can listen to that. But it's just my own thing. I really want it to be good. And good. If I can't do that, then I'm reluctant to put it out there in the universe. But
Let me also then mention about something that I know is still available, and that is your tremendous joke book. That reminds me. So oh. I know, because that was an on-demand publishing thing, I think, that anybody can order whenever.
Yeah, it still is. The audiobook is available, or the printed copy is available from lulu.com, mm-hmm. and they'll print it and deliver it to you, and we make a little money that way. We also have the audiobook version available on my website, and it is we have a sale on it right now, because I think everybody could stand to have a few laughs during these tough times. That book was written when Lisa and I were stuck down in Guatemala waiting for the adoption papers for our daughter Ava to clear the bureaucracy down there. And Lisa, in 2007, Lisa and I went to Guatemala to take over the foster care of Ava, who was 4 months old at the time. Mm-hmm. And one reason we chose Guatemala is we had heard that the process was relatively swift. And then it turned out not to be. And Lisa was down there for 9 months. And I was down there the last three of those. And during that time, I thought, well, I guess I should do something. So I ended up writing the book down there. And it was really great fun. And there's memories in there of some of the funny people I've known, like Jay Marshall and Billy McComb and Chuck Fain, Eric Mead, people like that. So they're good jokes.
Yeah, that's good. And, of course, the Worker series, which is, I think, like the new Tarbell. I mean, it's just got the best stuff, and I still do things that are from that. But before you go, I want you to also tell me what's one of your favorite jokes from that book, or perhaps a new one that you would add.
Oh, wow. Boy, a favorite one from there. Holy cow.
I mean, it just goes from one thing to another. I know of different subjects.
Yeah, geez, that's kind of tough. And it's also kind of tough to think about it in a...
it can be on the spot. Like, well, I remember you had said something earlier.
Well, okay, here's a joke that I think is really fun because it's an interesting joke. And after I tell it, we can discuss why it's fun. A fella goes to a doctor and because he's no longer to, shall we say, perform in a romantic way with his wife. And the doctor says, well, you know, it's never a good time to have this happen. But if it had to happen, this is a good time for it to happen because you have a number of alternatives that you can choose from. For example, for $5,000, we can do a surgery for you. And at the end of that, you could have sex with your wife once a month. The guy says, oh, he says, yes, but for $10,000, we can do a little more involved surgery. And at the end of that, you could have sex with your wife once a week. He says, really? He says, yes, but I have to tell you, there's a new cutting edge neurological surgery. And at the end of that, you'll pretty much be like brand new. You could have sex two times a day, every month for the rest of your life with that surgery. But it costs $25,000. What would you like to do? And the guy says, well, I should really talk it over with my wife. And the doctor says, absolutely. Come back and let me know what you decide. So he comes back the next day and the doctor says, did you make a decision? He says, yeah, we're going to remodel the kitchen. Now, what makes that a wonderful joke is that it always gets a huge laugh from men and women, but there's really two different laughs going on there. The men are laughing at one thing, the women are laughing at another thing, but it's a fine relative joke.
Which, again, the title of your book is That Reminds Me.
Yep.
So, as we wrap, that's the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. And I always like to close with knowing what it is that your philosophy of life, what do you live by? What is important to you? It can be a phrase, not necessarily a word. I'm not looking for abracadabra. I want to know what's your magic word.
Well, in the current situation, it's this. In times like this, a man has to believe in something, and I believe I'm going to have a drink.
It's a martini time.
Exactly. Got to be 4 o'clock someplace.
That's exactly right. Mike, it's always a great time to chat with
Scott.
You.
If I can just give a plug, the stuff that I put out that's new and available is over at michaelclose.com. And I do these little daily 4 p.m. Eastern time live videos on my public Facebook page, which is Michael Close Magic.
So, and that stays online also so that you can go back in the future and watch those.
Right. I haven't been getting rid of them, so there's a whole – we've done almost a month of them, three weeks plus, I guess.
Yeah, right. So that's great. Michael, thank you again very much. I appreciate you being my guest.
Thanks, Scott. So good to hear your voice again. Take care, my friend.
And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Michael Close. This is Scotty out. Well, that was really great. Thank you very much, Mike, for being my guest. And that was just a lovely conversation. And it's been too long trying to catch up. I'm glad we had quite a bit of time to sit and chat because normally, again, when we do see each other, we're going at different directions and different speeds. It seems like also I can't really sit down and chat. So this time we did. So thanks again, Mike. I appreciate that. And I hope that everybody enjoyed that and learned a lot from that, too. I got some interesting information out of our conversation. Well, a couple of weeks ago, we had a contest that was offered by Mark DeSantis. Susan, which he was offering a copy of his book along with a set of his DVDs, and we have a couple of winners. So it's time to announce their winners' names, and they are Ronald Barron and Jeff Christensen. Congratulations, guys. Thank you very much for entering the contest. And for those of you whose names were not drawn, you still can get discounted prices on Mark's products. And that information was provided in the recent pod letter. So if you don't subscribe to the pod letter, then you should. All the more reasons. That way you can learn how to get some good deals on that then as well. Well, I thank you guys very much for listening. This has been kind of a longer episode, so I'm going to get out of here and get ready for next week's episode. We've got somebody coming up who's going to be great. And if you subscribe to the pod letter, you already know because that's part of what we talk about there. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember, it's time to believe in something. So find out what it is you believe in and commit to it. I believe I'll go have a martini. After all, it is Thursday. This is Scotty out.